Short.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning. I'm grateful to be here. I'm West Short. I'm here representing the appellants. For the sake of clarity this morning, I'm going to be referring to the two publishers that are the appellants collectively as South Peak. We're here on a de novo proceeding to confirm an arbitration award. In response, TimeGate is attempting to show that the arbitrator undoubtedly exceeded his authority in amending the party's contract to bring the dispute to a conclusion. It's a very high burden because all doubts are resolved in favor of arbitration. So if it's even possible that the award draws its essence from the party's contract, the award must be confirmed. There's three issues I want to bring to the court's attention today. First is ownership. TimeGate talks about the ownership of the intellectual property and how the award interferes with their ownership. Something to keep in mind is that this was an unusual contract. In the publishing industry, the publisher normally pays for the development costs, and the publisher owns all the intellectual property, as stated in the briefing. Now, in this case, though, this was unusual. TimeGate was contributing $2.5 million to the development of the project, and as a result, received ownership in the project. And as a consequence,
they were supposed to contribute that amount, right?
And that's exactly my point, is that they were supposed to have contributed, but they chose not to. And perhaps more importantly, after a two-week trial, the arbitrator found that they never intended to contribute that money. So they essentially tricked South Peak into entering into this kind of contract. So the arbitrator could reasonably have found that TimeGate's intellectual property rights should not be strictly honored or strictly enforced. Second point I wanted to make is the perpetual nature of the license. TimeGate talks a lot about how this was converted from a limited license to a perpetual license. If you look at 7.1 of the contract, the existing license before the contract was amended was 8 years or 5 years past the last Section 8 product being published. So under the existing contract, had it been fully performed, and we know it was not, but had it been fully performed, then conceptually that contract could have lasted an indefinite period of time as long as the parties were continuing to publish Section 8 products under the contract, because it's the later of either 8 years or 5 years past the last Section 8 product that was published. So there may not be a significant distinction between the contract had it been fully performed and the contract as amended. Third issue I want to bring to the court's attention is the power to amend the contract, because that's really what it's about. TimeGate talks a lot about the differences between the contract before it was amended and the contract after it was amended. But the issue is, did the arbitrator have the power to amend it?
All right, back up on the second point concerning the 8 years and the 13. Say that again for me in terms of you're telling me the arbitrator's award of this indefinite time is synonymous to what could have occurred with the 8 and the 13?
It could have occurred that way.
But he doesn't say it that way, does he?
He did not. He just said it was a perpetual, it was converted to a perpetual license. But under the original contract, it was 8 years or the later of 8 years or 5 years past the last Section 8 product published. So as long as Section 8 products were continuing to be published by the parties, the time period of the contract would continually be extended for another 5 years. So as long as they were doing something, as long as they were publishing something, the contract would extend for 5 years beyond that. So theoretically, had the contract been fully performed, it could have extended for an indefinite period of time as long as they were continuing to publish. Now, on the arbitrator's power, this contract gave the arbitrator essentially unlimited power to bring this dispute to a conclusion. There was only one thing that they restricted, which is the power to grant injunctive relief. That was it. And then under AAA Rule 43, the arbitrator had the authority to grant whatever relief he deemed equitable and just and within the party's agreement. Perhaps even broader, though, the parties in their submissions essentially told the arbitrator he could do whatever he wanted. TimeGate's admission, for example, said that he could grant whatever relief he deemed just. So the power that the parties gave this arbitrator was as broad as any power that we've seen in any case. So I think the arbitrator could reasonably have concluded that he had the authority to amend the contract if that's what was necessary to bring this dispute to a conclusion. Secondly, though, the clause that Timegate points out, this, this general clause that says it can only be amended by the parties or their agents, I think the arbitrator, based upon this extremely broad power that was given to him, could reasonably have concluded that he was an agent of the parties for the purposes of bringing the dispute to a conclusion. And if that required amending the contract, then it did. There's case law out there that suggests that, that that the arbitrator is the agent of the parties for the purposes of bringing the dispute to a conclusion.
But how do we agree somewhere that that no one asked the arbitrator to amend the contract? Is that right?
No one specifically asked him what remedy to provide for the ongoing breaches, the breaches that would extend beyond the arbitration. Nobody said specifically, here's what we want you to do about that.
Were so, either of these the remedies? I mean, the remedy that the arbitrator ultimately provided, did either party articulate that as a demand? I mean, much analogous to us. You know, you ask for the relief you want, any alternative, et cetera, you know, we come down with something that nobody asked for. So even your reasoning back on point number two, I'm just trying to still let that sink in on me. I'm not suggesting that you can't award what nobody asked for, but it's initially just still striking me how to fit that within, quote, the essence, where, you know, in this dispute, nobody asked for this relief. Nobody's argued specifically under this contract terms, you know, it can be 8 years, 5 years, da-da-da-da, which if he says I'm in effect awarding relief in terms of how the contract would have played out, which is essentially a perpetual contract, I mean, I would readily get that. So I guess the tension is between what you're arguing, this broad, seemingly unfettered power to provide a remedy in this case versus clearly there has to be some limit where nobody expressly asked an arbitrator to do something. I mean, it can't be just unlimited that you can do whatever it is that you want and then under the guise of its arbitration say that that's okay. You follow me?
Well, the parties and specifically the appellants specifically asked the arbitrator to find that what Timegate was doing was a breach of the contract, and he did, and these were ongoing breaches that were going to continue. But neither parties, and we just gave him broad authority to fashion a remedy. We just said, give us whatever relief you think is appropriate under the circumstances. I think
surely you must have filed something telling him what you wanted.
Well, for the past conduct, we asked for damages. For the future conduct, we didn't tell him specifically which remedy to grant. And frankly, that was because we anticipated once he found the breach, we would simply take that to the district court and ask the district court to issue an injunction. However, the arbitrator didn't do that. He fashioned his own remedy, which he's permitted to do. The parties asked him to do that. We asked him to do that, to fashion a remedy that we show ourselves to be justly entitled to. And so we gave him the levity to enter whatever relief he deemed appropriate.
He came out with something far less than what you could have possibly contemplated. You're saying you'd have been equally comfortable saying, oh, yeah, well, we let you do it.
And that's what we asked him to. It's sort of a,
you know, so you were okay with whatever came out. So if it came out with less than what you wanted, far less, on another extreme, you'd still be arguing, well, that's the breadth of the arbitrator's power?
That is the power that we gave him. And the thing is, though, that and we weren't entirely satisfied with his result because, and this goes to the essence test, what he did is he created equality here. He said, Timegate, even though you breached the contract, you tricked us into this contract, you didn't pay in your share, and you went out and published two more Section 8 games without South Peak, I'm going to let you do that. I'm just going to give you permission from here point forward to do that. But I'm going to create equality. I'm going to allow South Peak to do exactly the same thing, which follows the intent and aim of the contract, because the purpose of this contract was for the parties to develop and publish Section 8 products and games. That was the purpose of this contract. Now, the contract provided that they were to work together. It was to be a collective effort. But given Timegate's conduct, it was clear that there was nothing this arbitrator could do to force the parties back together. So he had to come up with a way to further the aims of the contract without forcing the parties together, and that's what he did because he allowed these parties to move forward separately, that they could each pursue development and publication of Section 8 products themselves. So that he furthered the aims of the contract, perhaps in the only way it could have been, by allowing the parties to go forth separately, since it was clear they could not work together from this point forward.
Did your side put forth the damage model for future damages?
We did not, because they were too speculative. As a matter of law, we felt like they would be speculative because we didn't know how much the sales were going to be in the future. We didn't know what the profits were going to be. So it was impossible, frankly, for us to ask for that relief.
You said we gave the arbitrator the power to confect this remedy. Who is the other part of the we? Is it South Peak?
Well, there's...
Are you just speaking for your client?
I'm speaking for both sides, frankly, because in their submissions, we asked the arbitrator to grant us whatever relief we show ourselves to be entitled to in our submission. In TimeGate's submission, it was whatever relief he deemed appropriate. So it was just literally unfettered power to come up with a relief that it was appropriate under the circumstances.
And so that wasn't binding? That still allowed someone to appeal to the district court?
Well, we felt like it was binding, that, you know, if you give someone that kind of power, you can't then argue that they didn't have the power to do what they did. But the district court found that he somehow exceeded his authority. And that's why we're here, because the district court said, no, this exceeds his authority. It violates the essence test. And as to the essence test, though, what's so interesting about the arbitrator's award is it created absolute equality. It said, TimeGate and Southview, you can each go forward and further the aims of the contract individually without having to work together. And isn't that
Is that feasible? Is that doable? Is that realistic?
Well, I believe so, and here's the reason, is that TimeGate had been doing it already. I mean, TimeGate went out and published two more Section 8 games itself in competition with South Peak. So that had already been going on for some time now. So I think the arbitrator looked at that and said, well, if you're going to do it and you choose this remedy for yourself, I'm going to allow South Peak to have the same exact rights so that you all can go forward and pursue the aims of this contract, but separately rather than together.
Once they paid the money, Judge.
Well, it allows them to do it whether they pay the money judgment or not. The money judgment is a separate issue. It's for the past conduct, not for the future conduct. Because there's essentially two remedies here. One is the damages for the past conduct, and one is here's this ongoing stuff that we need to do in order to keep this contract alive.
Well, to follow up on the question Judge Clement asked you, I mean, in a nutshell, I mean, how does this work? I mean, in terms of them jointly or separately, I mean, I don't want to get too far down in it, but I'm trying to understand the concept of what, beyond the words, you got a perpetual good. I mean, and how is that?
Well, in the contract, it actually provided for that although the parties were supposed to work together, there were circumstances under which they could be in competition, where if one party gave the other a right of first refusal and that party didn't accept, then they could go out and publish their own game. That didn't happen in this case, but... So there could be competition, and it was contemplated in the contract, and I think in this industry, as set forth in our brief, there was a discussion in front of the district court that it's not uncommon for one publisher to publish one version of a game and another publisher to publish a different version of the same game. So
they can never get rid of each other.
Well, essentially, that's true. They're allowed to go...
Not too many institutions under our republic where, you know, you can't get rid of somebody.
Well,
so the arbitrator has more power than we have?
They have whatever power the parties give him, and the parties gave him essentially unlimited power. And you could argue here that what the arbitrator did was allow them to get rid of each other. It allowed them to go forward and do their own thing independently of each other without having to report to each other, without having to collaborate. It just separated the parties, but still allowed the contract to go forward.
Arbitrator must have been a domestic court arbitrator or judge at some point.
In giving the equal power to these parties, there's a Native American story about eagles, that eagles have two wings. And if one of those wings has less power than the other, then what happens is the eagle can't hunt, and it flies in a circle, and it will eventually die. It's a story about relationships, that the wings of an eagle have to have equal power in order for the eagle to survive.
Is there any case that, I mean, there are a lot of cases cited here, though, that, first of all, have this in a trademark contract, this perpetual existence?
Yes, there's one case that we cited extensively in our brief. It's actually a California Supreme Court case, though. It's AMD versus Intel, and the facts are shockingly similar to this case, where you've got one party who's essentially engaging in legal harassment of the other over intellectual property, over a contract that had an arbitration clause in it, and the arbitrator decided at the end of the day the fair and equitable thing to do was to give one party the intellectual property rights to the other so that they could go forward separately. And again, that's what happened in this case, is these parties can go forward separately and continue to pursue the aims of the contract. So this is not only a logical means of furthering the aims of the contract, it is probably the best logical means of furthering the aims of the contract, and perhaps the only logical means.
So if we were to be persuaded by you and reverse the district court, do we have to opine what the terms essence of the contract means for all purposes under arbitration law? I mean, is that a seminal question that this panel
Well, the question is just whether TimeGate has shown undoubtedly that this fails the essence test. We don't have to show that the court doesn't have to say that it does fulfill the essence test. The court just has to say that they have failed to establish beyond a doubt that it doesn't. It's their burden.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from TimeGate. Ms. Liberato.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Let me begin by answering your question, Judge Stewart, about whether you have to define what the essence test is. And the answer to that is no, because the essence test has already been defined, and that is that if the award is not rationally inferable from the contract, then the award violates the essence test. And that's what happened here, because the arbitration award turns the party's agreement on its head. It took what was an agreement to license, with a limited scope, to license this game and turned it into an award that gave all the intellectual property for all time to the other party in the case.
Well, where fraud is established, Texas law allows the arbitrator to void a provision in the contract, and in particular where it's fraud in the inducement, which he found here.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor, but even though the courts allow the voiding still is subject to the essence test. So there may be provisions of the contract that can be voided, which actually the judge did here, Judge Ellison did here, and still said they didn't violate the essence, but he then turned to this issue of the perpetual license and the other things that flowed from that and said that did go to the essence of the contract.
What wasn't the essence of this contract? A collaborative agreement where these parties were to work together to try to develop and market this product. And the arbitrator, to me, understandably, concluded these people couldn't work together anymore. And one party had already gone forward and was going out on his own to market the product. So as far as future losses are concerned, why not put them both on an equal footing? And that would reach more closely the essence of the contract than any other relief he could give.
Well, there's two parts to your question, and the first is whether this was the essence, and then the second part is whether this put the impact of this and whether this put them on an equal footing. If I may, let me answer the first question about what the essence is. To a degree, yes, that's part of the essence, what you defined as the collaborative work between the parties. But more importantly than that, there were express provisions in this contract that retained for TimeGate, the intellectual property. It said that TimeGate shall remain the owner of the intellectual property, and then there's other provisions that have that will be for a set period of time. And that sprinkled throughout the entire agreement, and quite frankly, and I think this is understandable, TimeGate would have never entered into this agreement if it thought it was going to have to give up its intellectual property. So I think that's the distinction of what the essence is. The essence, and there is a strong authority for this, is the essence is violated when there are express provisions that go to the heart of the agreement that are voided. The second part of it has to do with the question of, well, didn't this just put people on or put the companies on equal footing? And the fact of the matter is it doesn't put them on equal footing. Counsel used the analogy of the eagle and the eagle's wings. What this did is chop off each of those wings, and the effect being to kill the intellectual property, because it creates a naked license, and it allows the parties to go off on their own and essentially destroy the intellectual property, because no one has control, as it did under the agreement where TimeGate had agreement, to enforce infringement. It causes confusion in the market. I mean, I don't know too much about this. I've had teenage boys, and they play these games with each other. And so one person may have one version of Section 8 and the other another version, and they think it's the same thing, and they're playing together with it. The fact of the matter is that all of trademark and patent law is focused on protecting the rights to intellectual property, and whenever you split those out, that means there's no further protection. So this puts these parties, number one, in danger of destroying the intellectual property, but even more, in addition, because the arbitrator said that the contract's going to remain in force and effect, he didn't create just a perpetual license, he created a perpetual conflict. Because still, in this award, as it stands, the TimeGate has creative power over the games. There's requirements that there be information about each of the trademarks from each of them on the different products.
I thought it dispensed with the reporting.
And it did, right, that you're absolutely right, Judge, but the reporting had to do with the reporting of the sales and the proceeds. And the point of that is that that is how TimeGate determined how much money it was supposed to receive under the agreement. Well, what the arbitrator said is that TimeGate, you get no money now for your intellectual property. So that is one part it took away, but there is a logic there, because if we don't get any money for our intellectual property, then there's no need for there to be reporting.
Aren't you the one that didn't put the money up?
Well, that's what the judge said. The evidence, I mean, what the arbitrator said. It's not true, and the evidence shows just the opposite.
$4.75 million or whatever
it was? That's right, Your Honor. The evidence is that we put $3 million into the game, and that's what we were required to do, actually $2.5 million. They also claim that we gave them a crummy game. Well, the fact of the matter is, in the contract, there's a requirement of what are called milestone payments.
Well, the other party was supposed to put up the 7.5, right?
That's correct, okay. And we were supposed to put up 2.5. The evidence is we put up 3. And throughout the process, the way these things work is that there are milestones where the game is being developed and it's going forward. And here, every time we would reach a milestone, we were reported to them, as we were required to do, show them where we are and the progress of the game, and they would pay. And this happened 30 different times. And then at the end of that, there's what's called a gold master. That's, if you will, the grand finale of the approval. And we gave them the gold master. It was only after 2.5 years, all of those milestone payments, no problems from our standpoint, and whenever it came time for them to report to us and potentially pay us, then all of a sudden they complained about the game.
Well, you've got findings, though, by the arbitrator that are contrary to what you're saying, and you're bound by those, aren't you?
We are bound by those, and I was glad to be able to answer the question to put this in context.
The arbitrator found that of the money that GameCop put up, TimeGate spent $6.76 million and stuck the rest in their pocket. They failed to spend any of its money, the $2.5 million it's supposed to put up. I mean, you're bound by that.
We are bound by that, and we haven't challenged that, Your Honor. I just do it for two reasons. One, to put it in context, and two, because it's just kind of tough on us to hear what bad guys we are. But, yes.
And that you self-published a sequel and didn't report it to
Gamecock?
We had no responsibility to report that to them under
or share any of the revenue with them?
No, that's correct, Your Honor. We had no responsibility under this agreement to report that revenue to
I
them.
I thought Gamecock had the exclusive right to distribute.
They did, but this was for a sequel, and then for there's another product that's for a different type of port, which you'll see referred to in there as I'm sorry, as the PS3, which is PlayStation 3. On those, under the contract, that requires us to give them the right of first refusal or the last matching option if there is a third party that is going to publish or develop the game, and that never occurred. There never was a third party. And those two things happened after the dispute, particularly the sequel. The sequel was only developed after they, after we put them on notice that we were that they were in breach of the contract for not paying us. Judge, I mean,
given those findings, what relief do you think the arbitrator should have awarded?
Well, you know, I really grappled with that and thought the court would ask that question. It's hard to say. I think damages. It may be that he could have told the parties that they had to proceed under the contract, and given TimeGate, given South Peak revenue that was ongoing revenue. But the problem is that the underlying finding, and the reason that it's hard for me to honestly speculate about that, is that the underlying findings were so flawed, and everyone knew that. If you take away the three conclusions of law that were added in, obviously the arbitrator knew those weren't sufficient because he fashioned an additional remedy, a remedy that was wrong, but nonetheless one that shows that he thought that the award of damages, as he set it out, were not sufficient. The judge, Judge Ellison, was the same way. He said in our hearing, it's in the record, that if you remove one thread, the whole thing unravels. So he recognized that you couldn't just take away these findings.
Well, but I mean, our job is to look at the findings that are binding,
right,
and see if what's wrong with the relief. I mean, you know, we don't have the luxury of going behind those findings.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so, looking at them at face value, they violate the essence of the contract. I understand, and the court's of course correct that that we can't.
Looking at the findings, you're wrapped up in all the breaches that were found.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm just saying, wrapped up in the same set of facts, you're bound by all the adverse findings that were made as well.
We would be bound by those except for...
Well, you haven't traversed them. You didn't appeal them. You haven't traversed them. You attempted to give us context, but the reality is, I mean, that's what he found. That's within the record. You haven't traversed them there. You didn't traverse them to the district court. They're not traversed to us. So it's sort of irrelevant if, on a better day, you would have it be something else, but that's what it is. I mean, that's what it is. That's what's found. And that's there. So we're not going behind the facts. So we're looking at what's the essence of the contract in the scope of some very adverse factual findings made by the arbitrator about your client and its conduct in these proceedings.
So then the question is, in light of those, can he award the remedy that he awarded? And the answer is to that is no, because the remedy has to also fit within the essence of the contract. And here it does not fit within the essence of the contract.
What provision is voided other than the perpetual grant of the property right?
The perpetual nature of it, right, the term, the property rights as you identified, the right to create sequels, ports, and add-ons in any competing product.
That's no more than TimeGate's already been doing.
But that's not, we may have already been doing it, but they have the opportunity to do it too. And without going outside the record, there is evidence in the record that they did do it with a Russian version and then never told us about that.
Well, we don't have a finding of that as far as I know.
But the point, Your Honor, is that as you say, we're going on and doing it, but the problem is that as they go on and do it and we go on and do it, assuming that the award hadn't been vacated, then that's what will ultimately destroy this intellectual property. Because even though, as counsel said, there can be two companies, for example, that own the intellectual property, there's only one product. That companies create joint ventures, for example, with understandings and agreements among themselves on how they collaborate. So if you pull that collaboration apart and you have them going out in two separate directions using the same intellectual property, that's where it creates a naked license and where it causes confusion in the marketplace and ultimately harms the consumer and destroys the product. We have no control. Let's assume for a minute that this was reinstated, this award was reinstated. We would have no control over what they did, and yet we have other products that would be in competition, if you will, that would be in the marketplace.
Well, of course, when you've got a finding of fraud against you, then there's no legal prohibition against the arbitrator voiding a provision in the contract.
With the exception that it still cannot violate the essence of the contract.
Right.
And where Judge Ellison came down on this, the district judge, where he came down on this was he said that basically if he could see no way that this furthered the essence of the contract. And specifically, what he relied on was the fact that major parts of the contract were voided, as we've already talked about. He said, especially in light of the fact that no party requested the voiding, and this kind of goes back to some of the questions you were asking counsel earlier. He didn't rely on that, but he noted that that makes a difference, that nobody made that request. And then the second thing that he relied on in saying that the voiding in this situation violated the essence of the contract was that it changed the ownership of the property that is the subject of the contract. So those are his two reasons for saying that even though in certain circumstances it would be proper to void provision of the contract, this is not one of those circumstances because it violates the essence of the contract.
But in reality, wasn't this Section 8 game a commercial failure? I mean, is anybody going to go forward with this?
Judge, it was not. And as a matter of fact, they put out a press release. It's in the record saying this is South Peak. This was the most successful game that they'd ever had. And just logically, there wouldn't be ports sequels being sought to be created unless there was value in that, unless people thought they were going to make money off of it. So
you just want to pursue the sequels?
Well, the sequels and the ports and the add-ons, and if it's helpful, I can tell you what those are. I've learned a lot, but anyway, other aspects.
Upstairs full of old video things.
Okay, well then you understand. Yeah. So anyway, but the point being that it is a valuable game based on both the record and implicitly, I think, by the party's actions. But whether
do the sales figures, though, Chair, justify that or support that?
Well, they, as a matter of fact, they had, and I want to get this exactly right, gross revenue of the game at the time of the arbitration of $13.3 million. And they've continued to sell the game. So there is value in the game. They said there's value, and the record supports the fact that it's a valuable game. And I know it goes back to the evidence, but they didn't wait to have any complaint at all about this game until it was time for them to pay us money. And they never paid us money. They've never paid us a penny to this day, and they've reaped the benefits of this game that they say is not a game, including the $13.3 million.
Of course, if the arbitrator's findings are true, you can understand that, can't you?
Under,
understand if they found out what really happened, if it, you know, assuming the arbitrator's findings are true, you can hardly blame them for not paying you money.
If they were true, and we have to accept them as true, Your Honor, they submitted those findings verbatim to the arbitrator, which I know isn't, they're still the arbitrator's findings, except for the three conclusions of law that were added on. If I may, there was one other question that the court had and a point that was brought up about the perpetual nature of the license. And the statement, I believe, was made is that the license could continue as long as there were add-ons and ports and sequels. In fact, and I pulled it just to be sure, under Provision 17, Article 17 of the publishing agreement, it says that the term of the agreement shall be through the 8th anniversary of the first date of shipment of any game units, or, and this is the relevant one, the 5th anniversary of the first date of shipment of any port add-on or sequel. So the longest that the license would extend if there were ports, add-ons, and sequels would be this would be 5 years from the initial shipment, not from the last shipment. And that, again, is in Article 17 of the
agreement. Let me ask you this. What about what's your argument against affirming the damage part of the award and sending it back to the arbitrator to decide what should be about future relief
right.
for future
right,
relief.
Right, right. Well, there's two parts to it, Judge. One is procedural and the other is substance. On the procedural part, throughout this process, South Peak has argued vociferously against that, both in its briefing and directly to Judge Ellison in the hearings. And so that, and of course we have too.
We don't have to agree with either one of you or both of you, though.
Well, but I in this sense, Judge, you can do whatever you want. I understand that. But because they argue that as a practical matter, because that was their position, that you couldn't just take out some of these pieces, that was never developed in front of, that kind of argument was never developed in front of Judge Ellison. And so we really don't have a legal record where we could have explained to the judge why that wouldn't have been a good thing. And it's not something that we ever felt like that, well, we didn't have to, because we that was one of the I would say, rare times we were in agreement with South Peak. The other thing is that what that would amount to is a partial vacator, and the rules for that still go to this working outside the scope of the essence of the contract, outside the scope of the mediator, the arbitrator's authority. And everyone up until now, and I understand the court may consider that, but like Judge Ellison said, you undo one and it unravels the rest. So that's our argument, that everyone up until this point has understood that this was all tied in together. And that's why the judge, and specifically what the judge said was that, let's see, that the award cannot be modified or carry out the intent of the arbitrator in the award and the parties to the contract. So it was Judge Ellison's view that that would not be possible, and that's been everybody else's involved in the case. So.
All right. Thank you. I believe
thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Short, we're back to you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I find it interesting that neither opposing counsel nor Judge Ellison could come up with a better or even another way to bring this dispute to a conclusion than the way the arbitrator did. And I think that points to the fact that this really was the best, most logical way to further the aims of this contract while preserving the intent of the contract. These parties couldn't work together, so they obviously had to work apart to further the aims of the contract. I want to correct.
What do you say about the argument that splitting up the property right like this will wind up in losing the proprietary interest?
Well, first I'd say that's sheer guesswork on their part. And if you look at the Intel, AMD versus Intel case, the Supreme Court case we cite, AMD and Intel certainly didn't go under. after that opinion. So I don't think there's any precedent for if you have someone, two parties with the same intellectual property rights, that the intellectual property rights are completely defeated. I think that's just sheer speculation on their part.
So does this amount to just a dual trademark?
Well, each party has the same rights to the trademark, so I would say that that's correct. And again, that's the only way that anybody's been able to come up with to further the aims of the contract is to allow them to pursue it individually rather than collectively. A couple of misstatements I wanted to point out was that this game, as the arbitrator found, generated a cash loss for South Peak of over $7 million. So while they report, they point to some PR information that this was a leading revenue generator for the company, it was still a $7-plus million cash loss for South Peak. So it was a commercial failure for South Peak. And again, there hasn't been any change in the IP ownership. All that's changed is that the length of the license, and my opposing counsel is not correct in her reading of Section 7.1. It says it extends from 5 years from any SQL port or add-on. So as long as people are continuing to publish under the original agreement, as long as people were continuing to publish any add-on port or SQL, then that would extend the license for another 5 years under Section 17.1. So, and to answer your question, Judge Davis, under the Delta Queen case, which this court decided, partial vacature is a potential remedy out there, and we've suggested that as an alternative. However, again, I find it telling that no one can come up with a better way to bring this dispute to a conclusion than the way the arbitrator did in this instance, and there certainly isn't any indication that another arbitrator or this arbitrator on a second go-round would come up with a better way to do it. So, in conclusion, Your Honors, these parties selected and hired this specific arbitrator as their agent to bring all disputes under the contract to a conclusion. They bargained not for a court's decision on this, but for this arbitrator's decision, and they got exactly what they asked for. So we ask that his decision be in all things confirmed because it fulfills the essence test. Perhaps more importantly, because the arbitrator created absolute equality going forward, and we know equality is the very foundation of fairness, it fulfills the fairness test, and because it's the right thing to do. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, counsel, both sides.